Have you ever walked into a room, maybe it was a high-stakes meeting where your heart was thumping against your ribs, or a party where you didn't know a soul, and felt that immediate, heavy sensation of people sizing you up? It isn't just your imagination. We've talked before about how over 80% of a first impression happens before you even open your mouth. But what happens when the silence ends? That's the moment where most of us start to worry about losing our words or saying the wrong thing, especially when the stakes feel high. But here is something wild. Research suggests that your actual communication skills, how you bridge that gap between two minds, account for about 85% of your success in life. It isn't about being the smartest person in the room. It's about making the person across from you feel like a somebody. If you've ever felt like small talk is a chore or a barrier you can't quite climb over, you're essentially looking at an emotional bridge that hasn't been built yet. We're going to look at how to build that bridge in real time, using tools like mood matching and even unusual accessories to let others take the lead. It's about shifting the focus from your own anxiety to the verbal breadcrumbs the other person is dropping right in front of you. So let's dive into why the melody of your voice might actually matter more than the words you're choosing. It's easy to get obsessed with finding the right words, the perfect script that will make you sound confident and in control. But if you're sitting across from someone and you're already worried about how they'll react, you're missing the most important piece of data in the room, their current emotional state. Think of it like taking a voice sample. Before you try to steer a conversation or pitch an idea, you have to detect where the other person is mentally. One of the most effective ways to create an immediate emotional bridge is to match their mood and tone first. If they're speaking softly and thoughtfully, and you burst in with high-energy salesperson enthusiasm, you've created a clash, not a connection. It's like a mother instinctively matching a crying baby's intensity before slowly transitioning to calmer sounds. You have to meet them where they are to lead them where you want them to go. This isn't just about being nice. It's a tactical reset. When you feel that rush of anxiety in a tough conversation, your body is broadcasting your stress. You might notice your pace speeding up because you're in what experts call the ignition phase, where your rational thinking starts to get suppressed by your emotional reactions. By consciously slowing your pace by 10 or 15% and lowering your pitch, you're not just sounding more authoritative, you're actually signaling to your own nervous system that it's time to move from fight or flight into rest and digest. It's a way of controlling the pace of the room by first controlling the pace of yourself. Here's a counterintuitive thought. When we interact with others, there's a natural energy loss that happens in the air between us. You might feel like you're being perfectly clear and engaged, but to the person across from you, it can come across as flat or indifferent. To fix this, you almost have to perform a bit, exaggerating your emotional delivery by about 30%. This doesn't mean being fake, it means being prosaic with passion. If you say, "That's a great idea," but your delivery is flat, they may hear less enthusiasm than you intended. Exaggerating your emotional delivery by about 30% can help compensate for that loss. This is especially vital when you're dealing with the fear of negative reactions. We often shrink our delivery because we don't want to intrude or be too much. But that shrinking actually makes the conversation harder to sustain. Think about the difference between a you statement and an I statement. A you statement like, "You're being difficult," is a character verdict. It's inflammatory because it triggers shame, and shame doesn't motivate people to change. It motivates them to attack or withdraw. But if you use an I statement, like, "I feel frustrated when the report is late because it affects my afternoon planning," you're owning your experience while keeping the energy high enough to be heard. You're providing specific observable facts, things that could be captured on video, rather than global judgments. When you combine that 30% extra energy with specific behavioral descriptions, you become much harder to dismiss because you're speaking with a level of authority that is grounded in your own reality, not an attack on theirs. If you struggle with finding the right words to start a conversation, why not let the other person do the heavy lifting? This is where the concept of a what's it comes in, wearing or carrying something unusual that serves as a natural conversation starter. It could be a unique piece of jewelry, an interesting watch, or an accessory that prompts someone to ask, "What's that?" It's a simple trick, but it shifts the dynamic of social magnetism. Instead of you feeling the pressure to break the ice, you're providing the icebreaker for them. This ties back to the idea of sorting, our natural tendency to gravitate toward people we perceive as similar to us. When someone asks about your what's it, they're looking for a bridge, but once the conversation starts, the trap is falling back into power-draining phrases. You've probably caught yourself saying things like, "I'm sorry, but I think," or "Does that make sense?" These phrases signal uncertainty and a lack of conviction. Research has shown that leaders who used hedging language were rated 22% lower in perceived competence by their direct reports, even when the substance of their message was identical to a more directly worded version. So, once your what's it has opened the door, you have to walk through it with precision. Instead of saying, "I might be wrong," try, "based on what I've seen." Instead of asking if you're making sense, state your perspective directly. "Here's what this means for us." You're taking that initial curiosity someone had about your accessory and turning it into a moment of credible, authoritative connection. It's about moving from being an outsider to an insider by using language that commands respect without needing to be the loudest voice in the room. Most people think being a good conversationalist is about what you say, but the real masters are actually word detectives. This means listening, really listening, for the tiny verbal breadcrumbs people drop about what they're actually interested in. If someone mentions they were late because they were gardening or fixing the car, those aren't just random details, they are clues. A lot of us miss these because we're too busy planning our next sentence, but if you pick up those crumbs, the conversation practically writes itself. This requires you to step out of your own silo and get curious about the gap between what you know and what you want to know. There's this idea called reverse empathy, where instead of just trying to put yourself in someone's shoes, you imagine a time when you felt a similar emotion. If someone is being defensive or difficult, they're usually protecting something, their identity, their sense of fairness, or their competence. When you're a word detective, you're not just looking for hobbies, you're looking for what they care about. You can use empathizers, vocalizing complete sentences like, "I see what you mean," rather than just nodding or saying, "uh-huh." And here is the pro tip. Match your empathizer to the sense they are using. If they say, "I see what you mean," you respond with, "I get a clear picture of that." If they say, "I hear you," you say, "That rings true to me." This sensory matching creates an immediate subconscious feeling that you perceive the world exactly as they do, which is the ultimate form of rapport. If you want to be the most fascinating person in the room, the secret is actually to stop talking about yourself. Think of a giant revolving spotlight sitting between you and the person you're talking to. Confident people know they grow more by listening than by speaking. So they keep that spotlight firmly pointed at the other person. The longer you can keep them in the glow, the more they will like you. This is why sophisticated communicators avoid the standard, "What do you do?" which can be a total conversation killer if someone is between jobs or having a hard time. Instead, they ask, "How do you spend most of your time?" It gives the other person the freedom to talk about their work, their family, or their passions. And when you do find something in common, resist the urge to shout, "Me too," right away. If you wait, if you let them enjoy their solo on the topic before casually mentioning that you also love that obscure hobby, the connection you form is much stronger. It's a delayed revelation that feels more authentic and less like you're just trying to win rapport points. This also helps with the fear of negative reactions. If the spotlight is on them, you aren't the one being judged. You're the one being the supportive, curious audience. You can use strategic silence here too. After you make a point, just stop. Let the silence do the work. It signals that you're comfortable in your own skin and that you don't need to fill every gap with noise just to feel secure. When you're facing a truly difficult conversation, one where you're worried about losing your words or facing an outburst, you need a structure to lean on. Start with your opening frame. The first sentence of a conversation is the most important because it sets the trajectory. If you open with an attack frame, like, "We need to talk about what you did," the other person's brain immediately enters threat response mode. But if you use an inquiry frame, like, "I want to understand your side of what's happening with this project," you're inviting them to be a collaborator instead of a defendant. You can also use preemptive empathy, naming their likely defensive response before they even have a chance to say it. For instance, you could say, "I realize this might feel like I'm singling you out, and I want to address that directly." This diffuses the trigger before it fires. If things start to get heated, remember the 5-second reset. Inhale for 2 counts, exhale for 3, and press your feet into the floor. It's a tactical way to interrupt that amygdala hijack that makes you want to either yell or run away. If the other person throws a whataboutism at you, use the anchor and redirect technique. Anchor their concern by saying, "I hear you, and that's a real issue we should talk about separately." Then redirect back to your core point. "And right now, I want to stay with the documentation because that's what I'm seeing here." You aren't ignoring them, but you aren't letting them derail the conversation either. At the end of the day, confidence isn't about being perfectly polished. It's about doing things even when you're scared. It's about prioritizing grace over perfection. We often think that winning a conversation means getting exactly what we want. But sometimes the real win is just staying in the room and keeping the bridge standing. We've looked at how matching a mood can create an emotional connection, how a little extra energy can compensate for natural social friction, and how being a word detective turns the spotlight onto others. We've even talked about what's-its and the power of I statements to keep things grounded in facts. But maybe the most important takeaway is that conversations are live, unpredictable events. You can prepare all you want, but you still have to be present in the moment. When a conversation goes off track, and it will, you have the power to reframe it midstream. You can say, "I don't think we're having the conversation I meant to have. Can I try again?" That kind of honesty is incredibly disarming. It shows you're more interested in the relationship than in being right. So, as you move into your next challenge, maybe just try one thing. Wear something that invites a question. Or take that 9-second pause before you respond to a critique. You might find that the right words were there all along. You just needed to clear enough space to hear them. I'm really curious to see which of these tools feels the most natural for you to try first. Thank you for sitting with me through this and for being willing to look at these tough moments with a bit of curiosity. It's a lot to chew on, but the fact that you're even thinking about it means you're already halfway across that bridge.